Talk and Golf with Ann Liguori on The Fan. Sports Radio 101.9 FM and Sports Radio 66, WFAN and WFAN-FM, New York.
Well, good morning and welcome to Talk and Golf with Ann Liguori on this Sunday morning, June 16th. How are we doing? Talking Golf is brought to you by Travelers Championship, June 17th through the 23rd. Come see some of the world's best in Cromwell, Connecticut, including Brooks Koepka, Bubba Watson, and Phil Mickelson. And Talking Golf is also brought to you by Tourism Ireland, Golf Ireland. There's never been a better time to tee up your trip at ireland.com. Well, happy Father's Day. It is so great to be with you from beautiful Pebble Beach, the site of the 119th U.S. Open Championship, and to be here during the centennial anniversary of this famed Pebble Beach resort is very, very special. What a 100-year legacy. It's so beautiful here, whether Pebble Beach is glistening under the sun like it was earlier this week, or it's chilly and cloudy like it has been the last 4 days. I mean, it's freezing today. Either way, this course is stunning, it's dramatic, and if you're a golf lover, you have to be loving every second of this U.S. Open. This is the third U.S. Open I've had the opportunity to cover here at Pebble Beach. I was here 19 years ago, seems like just yesterday, when Tiger Woods destroyed the field, won by 15 shots. He was only 24 years old at the time. His scores were incredible, 65, 69, 71, 67, and he became the first to win a U.S. Open with a double-digit score, 12 under. I was also here in 2010 when Irishman Graham McDowell won here, and he became the first European U.S. Open winner since Tony Jacklin in 1970. So it's great to be back, and you'll hear all about Pebble Beach, its history, its lore, about all the courses you can play here, how much it costs to play here, to stay here. Neil Hoteling, the official historian of Pebble Beach, he'll join us after the 11:20 update this morning. And then at 11:40, we'll connect with Rich Lerner of the Golf Channel. And we'll take your calls the entire hour, so get on the line now, and we'll get into as many calls as we can, 877-337-6666. Would love to talk golf with you. The hour goes very quickly, so please get on the line as soon as possible. And what a leaderboard we have for this final round Sunday. Gary Woodland, the 35-year-old from Kansas, trying to win his very first major title. He won three PGA Tour titles to date, his third win coming at the Phoenix Open last year. And what an athlete he is. He played college hoops for the University of Kansas. He can just crush the ball off the tee. And he's been working with Pete Cowan, a renowned instructor from England, along with short game coach Phil Kenyon. And you can really see the improvement. Now he has a short game to go along with his long game. He shot a 269 yesterday at 11 under. He leads Justin Rose by one shot. And, you know, what impressed me the most about Woodland was the way he remained calm throughout the entire round yesterday. This is new territory for him. He's never been in the lead after 36 holes, certainly not after 54 holes in a major. So he's been handling it very, very calmly, and that's good to see. The par saves he made were stunning. On the par 3 12th, he hit his tee shot into fescue just above a greenside bunker. He had an awkward stance, and then he shanked his second shot. He was looking at bogey, possibly a double from where the ball landed, and instead he chips in from off the green to save par there. It was just an amazing shot. And then on the par 5 14th, he trains a 42-footer to save par there. So it was really a magical round for Gary Woodland. Three birdies, one bogey, but, you know, the par saves were really the highlights. And Gary Woodland knows he needs to take it one hole at a time.
I got to stick to myself. I know if I go out and play my game and can play like the way I've been playing, the guys from behind me are going to have to do something really, really special. So I'm going to go out, stay within myself, stick to my game plan, and, you know, try to extend that lead more than anything.
He also feels very comfortable with where he's at.
I've been in this situation a lot. I've had a lot of close calls even this year in tournaments. Obviously put myself in position in the PGA last year at the end of the year. So it's one of those where the game is just coming more complete, and with that comes a lot of confidence.
But Justin Rose is lurking just one shot behind. Rose has experience, composure. He already has one U.S. Open title under his belt. He won the 2013 U.S. Open at Merion. I remember that one as well, too. He became the first Englishman to win the U.S. Open in 43 years since Tony Jacklin did it in 1970. And talk about a super difficult golf course. Merion played the toughest than any other U.S. Open that I've ever covered. I mean, no one finished under par for 72 holes then. And Rose won with a one over par, 281. Just Jason Day and Phil Mickelson tied for second place at three over. It was another heartbreaker for Phil back in Merion in 2013 when Justin Rose won. Phil led or shared the lead in each of the first three rounds. It was actually the sixth time Phil finished as runner-up in the U.S. Open. More on Phil later, but Justin Rose knows how to win. He's been there before. He has game. Justin Rose discusses the key to winning today.
Same for Gary, same for probably anybody chasing. It's just good commitment, good focus out here, discipline, and then that little bit of luck, you know, making the right part at the right time.
And to make today's final round even more exciting, Brooks Koepka, who I think is the most mentally and physically tough player out there, he's going for a three-peat. Now, the last time anybody did that was 1905, a guy by the name of Willie Anderson. Koepka, he shot a 368, three birdies, no bogeys yesterday. He made some solid par saves, including just a dazzling long birdie putt from off the green to save par in the 15th to remain at 7-under. I can't say enough good things about Brooks Koepka and being only four shots behind. If Willand or Justin Rose falter, you know that Koepka, who enjoys the pressure, will be right there. It could be another historic finish for Brooks Koepka, and Koepka discusses his game plan for today.
Just stay patient. Just keep doing what I'm doing. Anything, you know, if you're within three on the back nine, anything can happen, and just stay patient. Hang around all day and keep fighting.
And being behind by four shots does not change his game plan.
No, it doesn't. Just get off to a good start tomorrow. Try to be within three going in the back nine, then you never know what's going to happen. That'll be fun. I'm looking forward to it.
Chez Reavy joins Koepka at 7-under, and he knows he has to avoid mistakes today.
The whole deal is just not making bogeys, right? Trying to figure out how to plot your way around each hole to give yourself the best chance to make par. You know, you make a few birdies out there if you make some putts, but, you know, you're just trying to, make a lot of pars.
Louis Oosthuizen, the 2010 British Open champion, is also four shots back. Louis Oosthuizen knows he can't make mistakes either.
I can't make mistakes like that on 11, giving a shot away on a hole that you should birdie. So no mistakes tomorrow. I can't afford it. I need to start well and just play a great round.
And then there's Rory McIlroy. Rory at 6-under is five shots back. You know, he's coming off his win last week in Canada where he won by seven shots. He's won four major championships, but his last one was back in 2014, 5 years ago. So Rory McIlroy knows and feels he has a great opportunity today.
I'm still a few off the lead. It's a wonderful opportunity for me to go out there and I guess try to add to my major tally. I've been very pleased with how I've played all week.
And he expects the course to be very difficult.
I felt for the most part today I did the right things, and I need to do 18 more holes of that, but just, get a little bit more out of the round tomorrow than I did today, and, expecting the conditions to be similar, but I could see the course just getting a little firmer and a little faster.
And happy birthday, Phil Mickelson. Phil turns 49 today on Father's Day on this, the final round of the U.S. Open. Phil, six times a U.S. Open runner-up, but unfortunately, Phil shot a 75 yesterday, finishing with a triple on the 18th. He's at +3 for the championship. He talks about his third round play.
I felt like I played a lot better than I'm scoring, and certainly didn't finish this round very well. But I'll tell you, I think it's I'm really happy that I had this chance, this opportunity this week.
And he discusses his bogey, triple bogey finish.
18, I couldn't get there. I just made bogey on 17, and if I hit a good drive, I'd be able to reach it. And really, it was a test for me. I've been working on my driver. I've actually driven the ball pretty well this week. I've had a nice turn of events.
Well, Phil is hoping to complete a career Grand Slam, but sadly for Phil, that is not likely to happen today. You know, he won here at the AT&T Pebble Beach Pro-Am in February, which gave him and all his fans some hope. But he's 14 shots back. Enough said. You know, he'll go out and have a good time today. It's his birthday. He loves it here. But sadly, that's, you know, he's not going to be able to complete a career Grand Slam unless a miracle happens. Tiger, he shot an even par 71 yesterday. He said he's had some opportunities.
I've had my chances to post good rounds today, this week, and today was a perfect example of that. I fought back, and if I would have been able to clean up my rounds the first 2 days, I certainly would have been a little bit closer to that lead than I am now.
The weather has definitely been a factor for the 43-year-old.
When it's cold like this, everything's achy. So it's just part of the deal.
It is cold. I have to say, it is really cold here. So Tiger, obviously, with the four back surgeries, you have to wonder if Tiger is just so elated, relieved, perhaps a bit surprised that, you know, given his comeback from four back surgeries and the fact that there was a time not too long ago in which he thought he might never play golf again, you have to wonder if his winning the Masters was enough for him this season and perhaps in the near future. I mean, sure, he always wants to win. He's Tiger Woods. But given his physical ailments, can he, will he win another major? Well, I'll put that out there for you to call in and love to get your opinion on that. We'll certainly ask Rich Lerner his opinion on that when Rich joins us at 11:40. Lots to talk about. Coming up, Neil Hoteling, the longtime historian for Pebble Beach. We'll get the lowdown on this special place. We'll take your phone calls at 877-337-6666. Who are you picking to win? Final round of the U.S. Open. Happy Father's Day. We'll be back with Talkin' Golf with Ann Liguori right after this.
It's Talkin' Golf with Ann Liguori on The Fan, Sports Radio 101.9 FM and Sports Radio 66, WFAN and WFAN-FM, New York.
All righty, good morning. Welcome back to Talkin' Golf, live from Pebble Beach. And Talkin' Golf is brought to you by Travelers Championship, June 17th through the 23rd. Come see some of the world's best in Cromwell, Connecticut, including Brooks Koepka, Bubba Watson, and Phil Mickelson. And Talkin' Golf is brought to you by Tourism Ireland, Golf Ireland. There's never been a better time to tee up your trip at Ireland.com. And I want to hear about your experiences here at Pebble Beach. Give me a call at 877-337-6666. I want to hear about your thoughts on Pebble Beach. Will Tiger win another major? Perhaps not today, but maybe in the future. Can Brooks Koepka three-peat? He's four shots back. Who are you picking to win today and why? And right now, I'd like to say good morning to Neil Hoteling, the longtime historian for Pebble Beach. Good morning, Neil. How are you?
Good morning, Ann. I'm doing great.
You have been here for, what, over 30 years as the historian for Pebble Beach, correct?
Yeah, I've actually worn a number of hats there, and the historian is the one that seems to fit the best. So,
unbelievable place. even in cold, rainy weather. It's cold
June
out here
gloom,
right now.
We call it.
June, but you know, earlier in the week it was, it almost was, what, 85 and sunny and just beautiful Monday, Tuesday. So it changes pretty quick, right?
It has. It's been an odd year. We actually had rain in May, which helped the course get into the good condition that it's in. It's just hard to imagine. People who aren't from California don't maybe know, but we get all of our rain between November and March. The rest of the year we get very little rain. So to have rain in May was very strange, and it was even thunderstorms. So. Which were even stranger in California. But yeah,
well, you know, how many times have I been here where I've flown into San Francisco, it's 85, 90 degrees, and you drive the 2 hours down to the Monterey Peninsula, and it's just cold here. It's just, you know, there's fog, and it's chilly. But when you get some of those brilliant sunny days, that's just, there's nothing more beautiful, right?
Absolutely true, and you never know when you're going to get them, because you can have a absolutely spectacular day in the middle of January, and then, you know, the cold and fog of June is not that uncommon. A lot of people may remember watching the 92 U.S. Open, where it was like this all week, and then just as the television cameras came on Sunday afternoon, the sun came out, and when the sun comes out, the wind usually comes with it, and it made the golf course just brutal, because they weren't expecting to bake out the greens in 92, and hopefully that won't happen this year. They've had great raves for Pebble Beach this year in the way the USGA set it up, and hopefully that will continue today. But if the sun comes out, watch for the wind, because it could happen.
Well, it's interesting that you say that. Sun, wind, we haven't had either. The course has played very soft. The conditions have been benign. The wind, there really hasn't been much wind, and that's so unusual, because normally in the afternoon you have wind out here.
A lot of the time, but again, when we get the June gloom, which we call the marine layer that comes in and sets a fog bank over the peninsula, then yeah, the wind doesn't come. The wind just kind of is gone when the cold ocean hits the heat of the valley and puts a cloud over the peninsula. I used to say people in Pebble Beach live with their head in the clouds, which is true a lot of the time.
That could be. Oh, that's a great description. But you know, I've played here when I couldn't see the first five or six holes, like 5 feet in front of me, because of the fog. But that normally lifts. You don't normally have fog here like all day. But yeah, the weather is definitely, you know, a key factor here at Pebble Beach. And for this event, it's been very, very gentle. But let's talk about the origin of Pebble Beach now. Talk about how this golf course came about.
Yeah, well, it was good fortune. We had the company was actually created by the railroad barons of California, and they had a hotel just the other side of Monterey called Hotel Del Monte, and they were going to develop all of the Del Monte Forest, where Pebble Beach is, into real estate lots. And there was a cloud on the title, so it got delayed, and then in 1915 they just decided to liquidate everything. And a man by the name of Sam Morse, who was just 30 years old, was put in charge of the liquidation of all of this land. And one piece of it was 20,000 acres on the Monterey Peninsula in Carmel Valley. And he looked at their plans for real estate, and he says, no, this is not good. We should put a golf course here. And they were in liquidation mode, and they weren't real keen on it. But he says, hey, I got a couple of amateur golfers that will lay it out. It won't cost you much. Our big expense is we'll put underground irrigation in so we don't have to hand water the golf course, but it'll be fine. And they said, okay, go ahead and build the golf course. So they built the golf course on the cheap. It took a couple of years of construction because they were basically using labor whenever they could find it. And Pebble Beach Golf Links opened in 1919. In the meantime, Sam Morse decided, you know, I think I'm going to buy this 20,000 acres down here myself and develop it. So Morse formed Del Monte Properties Company and opened the new lodge and Pebble Beach Golf Links the same month in February 1919, and managed it for the next 50 years till he died in 69. So that was kind of the beginning of Pebble Beach. It was a meager beginning, kind of off to a slow start. It hosted the California Amateur for the first time in 1920, got a few critiques of things that could be changed. He brought in Herb Fowler, the British golf architect, to actually redo the Del Monte golf course that the company had built in 1897, which was now part of Morse's Holdings, and asked him to give him an opinion on Pebble Beach. So Fowler went around and offered a number of opinions, the most amazing of which to me is that the seventh hole doesn't belong on any golf course, just get rid of it. And now,
wow,
of course, it's the most popular golf hole.
The most iconic hole here.
But the other thing he said was that 18th hole really needs to be lengthened because the original 18 was just a par 4. And Morse basically told him to go away and worry about Del Monte. Pebble Beach will be just fine. And then after the 1921 state amateur, the California Golf Association said, if you don't do something about 18, we're not coming back. So he brought Fowler back to lengthen the 18th, and they moved the tee back onto the rocks, and they moved the green forward closer to the lodge. And so from 1922 on, the 18th has been a par 5, and most people think it's probably the best finishing hole in golf.
Incredible, incredible. I know in 1926, Pebble hosted the first major U.S. amateur. Bobby Jones ties for medalist honors but doesn't win it.
Yeah, that was actually 29. In 26, we hosted a pro tournament that didn't get nearly as much press, but 29 U.S. amateur was played at Pebble Beach. And, yeah, Bobby Jones, everybody knew he was going to win. But he got down three holes. The first three holes he lost to a young amateur named Johnny Goodman, who had literally worked his way out on the rail cars from Omaha to get here, and beat Bobby Jones in the first round. And it was huge headlines, probably better headlines than if he had won. You know, Bobby Jones loses at Pebble Beach, so all of a sudden we were on the map. Yeah, the classic story there is that another young amateur by the name of Lawson Little, who was like 18, 19 years old, playing for the Stanford team, he was in the U.S. amateur, and he went up to Jones after the loss, and he says, "Mr. Jones, I'm really sorry you lost your match this morning." And Mr. Jones says, "Thank you, young man. That's nice of you to say." He said, no, I mean, I'm really sorry, because I was planning on going out and beating you myself this afternoon." And Lawson then went out and beat Johnny Goodman. And they were both relatively unknowns at the time, but Johnny Goodman is actually the last amateur to win a U.S. Open, which he did in 32. And Lawson Little, not unlike Brooks Koepka, won the British Amateur and the British Open. The British Amateur and the U.S. Open back-to-back two different years. So he had two amateur majors back-to-back for 2 years, like Koepka's. And then Lawson later won the 1940 U.S. Open. So he was a pretty good golfer.
Sounded like 29. He had the confidence of Koepka, too.
He did.
At an early age.
He did. And you were starting
talk about, Neil, talk about the Bing Crosby, the National Pro-Am.
Well, the Crosby was interesting. Lawson actually in later life moved to Pebble Beach and was living there. He had a home right on the first fairway, and Bing once said that he gave such great parties that if he could only refrain from his own hospitality, he might win the Crosby tournament himself. He would put up gallon jugs of martinis that everybody went to his house and enjoy. The party life of the Crosby was legendary, one of my favorite stories of Crosby was a golf writer who said, "I don't know why they call it a golf tournament anymore. Why they call it the Crosby anymore? In the old days, they used to party and chase girls, and now the boys bear down too much. The money's gotten too big. But what I love about that, it was written in 1953, when the parties were still legendary. So I'm not sure what Crosby he was thinking about, but maybe the one down in Rancho Santa Fe, because Bing actually started this pro-am tournament with his celebrity friends and professional golfers, where he put up the purse, and he started it down in Rancho Santa Fe near where he had horses on the racetrack at Del Mar, and they played down there until 42 and then stopped because of World War II. And then after the war in 47, he brought it up to Pebble Beach, where he had bought a piece of property right on the 13th hole at Pebble Beach, and he was a member at Cypress Point. He said, not only should we bring it up to Pebble Beach, let's use three different courses. So incredible. They used Pebble Beach, Cypress Point, and Monterey Peninsula Country Club. And the other big thing that gave the PGA Tour heartburn was he wanted the amateurs to play through on the final day. And they said, that'll never work. He says, it'll work, and I'm paying the fare, and I want to play. So they tried it. It's worked, and it's still working, even though they call the tournament now the AT&T Pebble Beach National Pro-Am. The format really hasn't changed that much in the 70-plus years that it's been here.
So Bing, he wanted to play. He put up the money. He did it all. And we were talking earlier, and, you know, I know Catherine Crosby, and years ago when she had told me, Bing, before he passed away, had told Catherine, listen, if this clam bake ever gets too commercialized, just go somewhere else. Keep the tournament going and take it somewhere else. So Catherine took him to heart and did this tournament, did a celebrity tournament in North Carolina. And I was honored to be invited every year. I went for 8 straight years, and she had all kinds of celebrities playing. Thousands of people came out to watch, and she had hundreds of volunteers. It was a wonderful tournament, but I'll never forget the very first time I played in it, she put me in a foursome with her sons, Nathaniel Crosby and Harry. Nathaniel, only an amateur champion, right? And yeah. It was just, and she'd drive the cart around, and she was wearing all white. She had the white hat, she had the white long gloves, and, you know, she protected her fair skin, and she was following us the entire 18 holes. And Nathaniel, it was so much fun to play with Nathaniel and Harry Crosby, because they were so competitive with each other, the sibling rivalry, and they were just, you know, harassing each other and trying to outdrive each other. And just to be a part of that was something I will never forget. And, you know, unfortunately, that tournament stopped years ago. But Catherine really did a good job with it. And that was kind of an extension of the clam bake for many, many years on the East Coast.
Yeah, absolutely. And she stayed away from Pebble Beach for 20 years after that. And when she did come back, Harry and Nathaniel were playing, and I actually walked several holes with her following Harry and Nathaniel at Spyglass Hill, and I saw that competitive nature in them while I was working with Catherine pushing the grandchild in the baby cart.
Well, talk about Neil. Neil is the official Pebble Beach historian, and talk about the current ownership now.
The current ownership is a great group. And a lot of us still call them the new ownership, but they've been here 20 years already. The longest ownership group other than Sam Morse. There was a big transition from Sam's death in 69 until their purchase in 99 with a couple of Japanese ownerships and whatnot. But the new group was put together by Peter Uberoth and Dick Ferris. And most people are familiar with the Peter Uberoth name. He came to fame with the 84 Olympics and then was the commissioner of baseball. But he actually got his start in tourism and started Hawaiian Airlines and a few other things before doing the Olympics. And Dick Ferris, the name most people don't know, but he was on the PGA Tour board and also got his start in the tourism industry. He used to work for Westin Hotels as an executive, and then when United Airlines bought Westin, he went with Westin to United Airlines and ended up becoming chairman of United Airlines. So he was a pretty powerful guy. And he and Uberoth got together after he left United Airlines, and they started a little hotel group and built it into the DoubleTree. So they had some experience. And they also had a lot of familiarity with Pebble Beach. And when the second Japanese owners decided they were going to sell, Peter and Dick got together and grabbed in Arnold Palmer and Clint Eastwood as kind of their surrogates to work with them on the board. But Peter and Dick were the co-chairs, still are the co-chairs, and Arnie was the guy who really looked after golf, and Clint is actually very well politically connected in California, and that was important to the things that the company wanted to do. So they put together a team that they thought they might not be able to put together the best money, but they could put together the best team that the Japanese would want to sell to, because their plan is to never have Pebble Beach sold again. They want to keep it in an ownership group that never has to change hands, and that seems to be what they've set up. And 20 years later, they're all still there, except for, of course, Arnold passed away a couple of years ago. But the company has been run by this group since 99. They came in literally a month before the 99 U.S. Amateur and then hosted the 2000 U.S. Open, and now they've hosted the 2010 and they're hosting the 2019. So great group, and they've done some wonderful things with the property. They built the new Pebble Beach Golf Academy. They've got the new Fairway One complex of hotel rooms at Pebble Beach. They've redone every room on the property and modernized. So it's just been a terrific ownership group.
Neil, thank you so much. I could talk for hours. I love this history, but very insightful. I appreciate you coming on and sharing your experience and knowledge about Pebble Beach.
My pleasure. I live it, so it's a great thing to talk about.
Neil Hotelling, thank you so much. And, of course, if you're in this area, Cypress Point is just incredible, very exclusive. It was started in 1928. Pebble Beach opened in 1919, 100 years ago, obviously. Monterey Peninsula, the Dunes Course, the Shore Club. The Peninsula Dunes opened in 1926. Spyglass in 1966. Poppy Hills in 1987. And Spanish Bay in 88. That would be just, if you could play all those courses in one trip, that's like a dream golf trip for sure. All right, well, we're going to take a quick break, come back, talk to Rich Lerner of the Golf Channel. So stay where you are, talking golf live from Pebble Beach.
It's Talkin' Golf with Ann Liguori on The Fan, Sports Radio 101.9 FM and Sports Radio 66, WFAN and WFAN-FM, New York.
Welcome back to Talkin' Golf live from Pebble Beach. Talkin' Golf is brought to you by Travelers Championship, June 17th through the 23rd. Come see some of the world's best in Cromwell, Connecticut, including Brooks Koepka, Bubba Watson, and Phil Mickelson. And Talkin' Golf is brought to you by Tourism Ireland. Golf Ireland, there's never been a better place to tee up your trip at ireland.com. And joining me now, Rich Lerner of the Golf Channel, host of Live from SAS, and most importantly, Rich, you used to work for WFAN.
Hey, good morning.
Morning.
That was a fast 30 years, wasn't it?
Where did the time go?
I know. I was thinking back to that time, and I didn't know it then, but man, I was fortunate to have worked around some legends, and you've become a New York legend, but Lou Botha, Lou Palmer, Spencer Ross was there. Jim Lampley was at WFAN. Mike Francesa was, I think, just sort of starting out. We were all just kind of starting out. And then obviously Steve Summers. I remember being there overnights. He was so nice to me. We stayed at I don't know if the studios are still in the same spot, but we used to stay in the Marriott out there. And it was just insane. The late John Pruder hired me on a recommendation from Marty Glickman, who was a friend of a cousin of mine. Anyway, it was a great time.
It was a great time. Great memories way back when the station started in 1987. And, yes, the station has moved, Rich. We're no longer in Astoria. We're in Lower Manhattan.
That's where it was, right?
Yeah, we're in Manhattan now, Hudson Street. But we're in Pebble Beach, and
long ways from Queens, aren't you?
A long ways from Queens, and it's freezing out here, but we did have some gorgeous weather earlier in the week. And I just wanted to mention, mm-hmm. I was one of the originals on the Golf Channel with, you know, my own TV series. So our paths have crossed professionally, you being at FAN, me being one of the originals at the Golf Channel, and now you're there, and this is probably a dream job for you, right?
It is. And my father, rest in peace, Les Lerner, opened a driving range in Allentown, Pennsylvania in the 1950s. It was a driving range fully lighted par three in a miniature golf, pinball room and a hot dog stand. Played a little too much. I played a little too much Donkey Kong and Galaga. Otherwise, I might be playing golf for a living. But it was a wonderful place to grow up. My three brothers and I ran it for my dad for a long time. It was in the family for over 30 years. It kind of became an institution in the Lehigh Valley. It was a quick, funny story. My dad, fresh out of the Wharton School of Pennsylvania, was an entrepreneur, and he had this great idea. He'd approach this burgeoning star from the other side of the state by the name of Arnold Palmer, who had just won a Masters, with the idea that we would put Arnold's name on this new venture, and we'd have a string of Arnold Palmer golf centers across the United States. That sounds good, doesn't it, Ann?
Oh, my gosh.
Well, Arnold was a shrewd businessman in his own right.
When
my father found out Arnold's asking price to lend his name to this new venture, Dorneyville Golf Center was born, named for the little borough on the edge of town. we lovingly, the boys called it the Divot. That was its nickname. But anyway, that's how I got into the game. So, yes.
And you and I used to talk golf at FAN in the early days. So I know you've always been focused on golf. And this is such a great opportunity for you to do
it's
what you're doing.
It's been great. 23 years now, Ann. Yeah, I'm loving it.
Unbelievable.
Thank you.
And such success. And how special is this venue? I mean, from a TV standpoint, Rich, the camera angles, the scenic shots, it just really doesn't get any better than Pebble Beach, even on a cloudy, kind of rainy day.
Yeah, there are just certain places out there where it's just you and your maker, you know, and it's just in a little white ball, and you feel really blessed to be able to play this game. I always say golf's great for a lot of reasons. It's not perfect, but it's great for a lot of reasons, I think principally for where it takes us. You know, it can take you to just some amazing places, and this is one of those great places.
Very, very special. And the leaderboard and the storylines, they've lived up to the grandeur of this iconic venue.
Yeah.
Seven major champions, Rich, within seven strokes of the lead.
Yeah, I think it's there are a few things jumping out right now. I mean, I think we've all warmed up to Gary Woodland. You know, country's starting to get to know his story. You've known it. I've known it for quite some time. You know, Gary played all sports growing up in Kansas. He's a Topeka kid. He wanted to be George Brett. He was obviously, you know, physically gifted when he was young. Basketball was his first love. Danny and the Miracles, Danny Manning and the Kansas Jayhawks. And he ended up playing at Fog Allen Fieldhouse in college, but not for Kansas, but for Washburn University Division II. And Gary was a good player. He was All-State in high school, scored 26 in the state title game. But in a game at Fog Allen, he had 2 points. And that's where it sort of became apparent. And that was against Wayne Simeon and Nick Collison and who else was on? Kirk Heinrich was on that team.
Right.
It became apparent that he didn't sort of have the hops for high-level hoops. And so he shifted his focus to golf, and he transferred to Kansas and finished his college golf career there, always intent on being a professional athlete. What he had just always thought it would be in basketball, but then he turned his focus to golf. He hired Randy Smith, who was a very prominent instructor in the Dallas area, who worked with Justin Leonard, and then he just began the long process of refining his game. I remember seeing Gary at a charity event about a decade ago when no one knew who he was. And this is rare, and you've been on driving ranges before. Pros aren't easily impressed, right? They all hit the ball great. Well, they gathered round. The other pros gathered round to watch this guy they hadn't heard of launch balls over the end of the driving range. He was that prodigious. And so he just sort of began this process of chipping away and adding polish to his game. And that's what we've seen the last few days is a guy who's not just a hitter, but who can chip and putt. We'll find out today. It's a whole different ball game. Can you do it under, you know, the pressure of Sunday at a major championship with guys breathing down your neck? And the one guy we're all looking at is Brooks Koepka. That's the guy right now.
That's right. I mean, amazing. And, you know, to me, it looks like it comes down to two mega athletic prize fighters duking it out at the end. You know, you have Gary Woodland, as you say, who crushes the ball. And, you know, he's worked with Pete Cowan and the short game guru, Phil Kenyon. So he has a more complete game now. But Koepka, to me, represents the best of the modern-day athlete. He's just a physical specimen with that mental toughness to match. So can you imagine if these two are just duking it out? I mean, not to take anything away from Justin Rose, because Rose is so poised to win a second U.S. Open. But these two, you get the Woodland Koepka, you know, connection with their athleticism.
Well, this is sort of in the Dustin Johnson mold. These are all the guys who have the dude walk, right? They saunter. they look like guys who just struck out the side on 9 pitches, high heat, clocking 102 on the gun, and they just very casually saunter to the dugout as if nothing really happened. That's that kind of athletic arrogance that you need to play at the high level, the physical strength, the confidence oozing, all of that. I'm fascinated by Koepka. You know, I mean, if people who, you know, who aren't fully, you know, on top of golf, he's trying to do something that hasn't been done since before the silent movie era. You know, since 3 years before Henry Ford rolled out the Model T. That's when 3 U.S. Opens in a row, and the last to do it was a guy named Willie Anderson, a Scotsman, back in 1905. 3 U.S. Opens in a row, on top of the 2 PGA championships he's now won consecutively. I mean, this is a deep and ruthless dive into history here. And what I like about Koepka is he has a quiet mind, but he also has sort of a Tom Brady-esque healthy disdain for people who overlooked him, the chip on the shoulder, a little bit of FU, to be blunt about
it. And I think people still overlook him because the whole world is so obsessed with Tiger, whether he's playing great or whether he's struggling. And so a lot of these great stories kind of get lost, right? I mean, Koepka is, this is an amazing story.
They'll never measure up to Tiger. We know that. But purely on numbers, if Koepka wins today, this is a Tiger run. When he will have won 5 majors in his last 9 major championship starts. That's Tiger stuff. Now, the last time somebody was on the cusp of really serious history would have been Jordan Spieth in 2015, when he had a crack late in the final round at the Open at St. Andrews to win a 3rd straight major of the year. That would have matched what Ben Hogan did in 1953. So there's an undeniable bigness to what Koepka is doing. Again, it's the clear thinking, the ability to handle pressure. I asked him in an interview I did with him in February, I said, what are the ingredients that make up a great athlete? And he did not hesitate. He said straight away that it's between the ears. So you look at all the great athletes. You look at all the great athletes. You look at Jordan. He mentioned LeBron. He mentioned Tiger. He said 99% of their wins came from the way they attacked mentally, the way they handled things psychologically, the strength they
had.
That
is so true. And I think Koepka,
and that's really it.
He's so strong mentally, one of the toughest mentally that I've seen of any athlete. Let's talk Tiger quickly. Do you feel, Rich, that Tiger's still worn out from winning the Masters? I mean, he's achy. And the weather hasn't cooperated for him. I mean, he couldn't putt this week.
Right. You know, whatever happens the rest of the way this year, whatever happens the rest of his career, 2019 will always be a memorable season because of what he did at Augusta, period. End of discussion. I mean, hadn't won a major in 11 years. We weren't sure it was ever going to happen again, and he did it. He stretched the limits of sports immortality. That's done, and we put that in the history book. So, you know, the questions, you know, popped up. Can he get to Nicklaus? That was always the goal since he was a little kid. And I think what we're seeing now is it's probably too big an ask. You never say never with Tiger. But keep in mind that nobody in the history of golf has ever won more than one major after the age of 43. And Tiger turns 44 in December. And you're seeing it. The body's just not as lively. If it's a little cool out, doesn't react quite as well. Putting typically into your 40s gets a little worse. Yeah, I thought he played well this week. Small greens, great iron player. Historically had been pretty good on these greens, the POA greens. He won 2 U.S. Opens here in California. Remember the bumpy putt that went in at Torrey Pines in 2008 against Rocco. So onward we go, and he's still big. Fans still want to see him. It's good to have him back because 2 years ago, Ann, May of was the 2017, I thought it was going to end badly.
Right.
And he's put it back together.
And he said in the fall of 2017 he didn't think he'd ever play again. He said that. So this him is gravy for sure.
Correct. Yeah, and he's sort of – I always thought, look, he has and had a gift for this game and to entertain people who love the sport and love to see athletic greatness. The gift was almost squandered, and it's been recovered personally for him. Nice that he can share it with his kids who are a little bit older. That's important. Any parent would know that. And then to share it with everybody else, we're thrilled that he's back. But I would suspect we're going to get it in starts and stops. But anytime he tees it up, we'll wonder, is this the week?
Absolutely. Well, we're out of time. This hour goes so fast. But before I let you go, Rich Lerner, who are you picking to win?
Well, I'll say Koepka.
Okay.
Koepka's hitting the ball great. He just needs a few putts to drop. Best Sunday we've seen that. He's best on Sundays. Rose and Woodland have been reliant, I think, a little too heavily on their putter. And when the pressure ratchets up, that's the first thing you start to see that begins to crack is usually the putts that have been dropping Thursday, Friday, Saturday don't on Sunday. That's the easy sort of quick analysis. You never do know. I'll say Brooks Koepka makes history today. And I will say the last thing, Annie, is if he does win, he is the first bona fide legend of the post-Tiger generation. Bonafide legend, rock, a granite rock legend of this generation. Rory's close. Jordan's, had been close, but this is a different level if he wins today.
I agree. I'm picking Brooks as well. There's nobody stronger mentally, and plus it helps if obviously you have luck on your side, and he just is able to pull out some of those crazy good par saves, to make it happen. But hey, if Gary Woodland can hang in there, what a win it would be for Gary Woodland for sure.
Great, no doubt.
Hey, thanks so much, Rich Lerner. Let's do it again soon, okay?
Thank you. Have me on anytime. Congrats on all your success. Thanks for having me on.
Really appreciate it. Rich Lerner of the Golf Channel, host of Live From. Well, boy, this hour goes so fast. I hate to see it go. My thanks to Paul Rosenberg, Connor Green in the studio. The legendary Richard Neer is up next. He's a golf fanatic. Enjoy the final round of the U.S. Open on this Father's Day. Thank you so much for listening to Talkin' Golf with Ann LaGorrie.